This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The new Bloomington budget includes no property tax increase again, but Alderman Diana Howman says that might not be true next year.
I think we've passed that line. If we're going to continue to raise salaries, we need to be factoring that into our property taxes.
GLT News spoke with three aldermen about the new budget. GLT's Ryan Denham reports. Find out what it takes to move from city to smart city. The chief information officer for Kansas City, speaking in Normal tomorrow, says most cities are already surprisingly close. And GLT's Charlie Schlenker talks about the city budget, the welcoming city ordinance, and boat docks on Lake Bloomington with Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's April 10th, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Things have been tense on the Bloomington City Council in recent months with public confrontations between Alderman and Mayor Renner. But last night, they passed a new $210 million budget. Aldermen say the budget process was actually smoother this time around, led by interim city manager Steve Rasmussen. WGLT's Ryan Denham spoke to several aldermen just before the budget was passed about what it will mean for residents of Bloomington.
The new budget may be balanced, but Alderman Karen Schmidt says the city needs to spend more time looking at cost control. Schmidt represents Ward 6, which includes parts of downtown and much of the city's west side. Here's her take on the new budget.
Well, it's certainly going to raise fees for people in terms of handling their garbage, and we'll also be implementing a new stormwater and sewer fee, so it becomes more expensive to live in Bloomington. We continue to be challenged with not controlling our costs, and some of that has to do with getting our hands around our workforce and the pension and benefit obligations that come with hiring people. Really kind of rethinking the way that we do business.
Some of the biggest changes for residents will be in solid waste. Higher garbage collection fees go into effect May 1st, and there will now be only two bulk waste collections every year, instead of every other week. Alderman Jamie Matthew from Ward 1 in South Bloomington says the city offers high-quality garbage service, and he heard from constituents who didn't want to lose it.
We have great services that we offer, and people are very accustomed to them, and they didn't want to give those services up. One of the conversations I was personally disappointed we didn't have was, did we want staff to go out and collect information on possibly privatizing or outsourcing the trash pickup. And there was a outpouring from the community of phone calls and emails we got. And the overwhelming sense was that people didn't want us to do that. They wanted to keep the services where they were. They wanted to keep it in-house with our Public Works Department, who does a great job. They wanted to keep it in-house. But that premier service has a premier price tag that goes with it.
The new budget also includes a sharp increase in sanitary sewer and stormwater fees that will bring in an extra $2 million a year to help the city attack $134 million in capital needs over the next two decades. Alderman Diana Howman from Ward 8 on Bloomington's east side praised the city's public works team for taking that approach to infrastructure needs.
Well, I think they're setting a good example for the other departments in terms of being proactive. They already had some money set aside. Wasn't enough to cover what they needed to do. And again, water is a basic city service. We pay for the consumption, but the water and the sewers and the stormwater, that's a need for the city.
Hammond says it's a solid budget, but she wishes aldermen would have made some decisions on whether to increase the local motor fuel tax. In February, during budget talks, city staff proposed doubling the city's gas tax from 4 to 8 cents. That would have raised an additional $2.3 million for streets and sidewalks. But aldermen were cool to the idea. Matthew supported it, and so did Hammond.
For me, I fill my car up twice a month, and it would be $14.40 a year for me in increased motor fuel tax, $1.20 a month. If I would rather invest my money in a little more in motor fuel tax than new tires, front end alignment, etc.
The new budget also doesn't resolve what the city will do about the aging O'Neill Park pool. Matthew says there's a lot of decisions still to be made on big capital projects.
Part of all this is going to be a community conversation to say, what is the value of these various things to the community? You know, we know from Chief Hefner that if we don't give kids things to do in the summertime, they're going to go find their own things to do, and we might not like that result. It's one of the reasons why City Council has invested in the Boys and Girls Club to help with programs over there. It's one of the reasons why a lot of the officers volunteer their time at Boys and Girls Club or at the Jefferson Avenue Community House to help build those relationships with the kids in the community, make sure those kids have things to do. So there's implications to not fixing the pools.
Like many municipalities, the city of Bloomington's revenue sources are strained and flattening out. The state also just started scraping an extra 2% off sales tax collections. But again this year, aldermen did not raise property taxes to balance the budget. Property taxes make up around 12% of that budget. Alderman Schmidt says changes in the local economy may force discussions about raising property taxes ultimately.
It's going to become a critical conversation for us in the next year or so, and it's made more difficult by all of the changes that are going on in our business community right now. We have to be very mindful of some of the turmoil that's going on with changes in business models with State Farm and just the general movement within retail as well. So we want to... I get concerned when we don't get our hands around property taxes, and we offload some of our expenses into service taxes. And I think the one that bothered me the most was utility tax, because I think, you know, we raised our utility tax a few years ago to pay for a pension, and I ended up voting for that because I thought we agreed that we were going to go back and look at our property tax and try to put pension cost into our property tax, but we never did that. So basically what we did was, you know, tax everybody in town through the utilities, and including people who are least able to afford it.
At some point, the city will face either raising property taxes or making deep service cuts. Here's Schmidt again.
I think it's going to have to be within the next year or two, and just realistically, either that or we're looking very serious. We would have to be looking very seriously at reducing services or outsourcing services, or those are really our choices, and really changing the way that we do business.
Hallman says there's already a need to raise property taxes.
I think we've passed that line multiple years ago. If we're going to continue to raise salaries 2.5%, 3% a year, we need to be factoring that into our property taxes and adjusting the property taxes based on that. I mean, one of our biggest expenses is payroll, and we keep eating those increases and taking money away from other departments, other areas, rather than passing that on to the property owners.
Matthew says there are larger factors at work that may steer the council toward property tax increases.
We have, as a society, increased the quality of life to the point where people are now living to be 87 for women and 84 for men is now the expected life expectancy.
People born now, yeah.
Yeah, so it's very possible to be retired and live for 20 years or longer after retirement. When the retirement system was created, the average life expectancy for men was 63. Most people didn't even live long enough to retire. And now we've shifted that bar, and that's great for all of us, but the simple math of the system doesn't work anymore. And we as a state, as a city, as a community need to come together to realize that something has got to change someplace. You know, it's and I don't know what that looks like yet, and I'm not advocating for anything, but we need to have realistic community conversations on the fact that the math doesn't add up anymore, and what are we going to do about it? how do we treat the people we have made promises to correctly and plan for the future at the same time?
Aldermen are also keeping an eye on Grossinger Motors Arena. The building is an annual drain on the city's budget, though it brings in economic development dollars to local businesses. VenueWorks is nearing its two-year anniversary of running the arena. After 9 months of this fiscal year, the arena's net loss stands at $718,000. Fiscal year ends April 30th. The city can exit its contract with VenueWorks in 2019. We asked Alderman Matthew whether the city should consider any changes to oversight of the arena.
Not quite yet. Soon, but not quite yet. And the reason why I say that is because this budget cycle for the arena has also been coupled with the factor of we've had some incredible workforce changes in Bloomington that started last fall, right after the last budget year. I know I had close friends who didn't know if they were going to have a job starting in last September all the way into January, and they put everything on hold. They didn't start remodeling on their house. They didn't. Christmas was a very slim affair last year for them. When people are uncertain about their work and if they're going to have a job, they literally went into turtle mode and stripped all expenses and all finances down to the bare minimum in case there was no work and there was no money coming in. And so I think we have an external factor that's going to last for, you know, from what I'm hearing, probably at least another year at this point, that is, it's going to affect the and reshape all of Bloomington Normal. And we have to all come to this understanding on there.
That's Alderman Jamie Matthew. Before that, it was Alderman Donna Holloman and Karen Schmidt. I'm Ryan Denham.
You can catch up on GLT's coverage of last night's city council meeting right now at our website, WGLT.org. As you heard, aldermen have approved a budget for next year. They also resolved a long simmering dispute with some residents around Lake Bloomington. Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner is in the studio to talk about all of that and the welcoming city ordinance with GLT's Charlie Schlenker.
The mayors of Bloomington Normal stopped by GLT's Sound Ideas following their regular and special council meetings. Mayor Terry Renner, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks, John.
As you just heard in Ryan Denham's report, aldermen are, well, not happy but satisfied with the budget, but they're also acknowledging it's not the end of a painful multi-year process. Aldermen Schmidt, Hellman, and Matthew are saying that property taxes will likely have to go up in the next year or two to continue to stabilize city finances. What do you think?
I think, generally speaking, I'd like us to stay away from in our finances from any kind of property tax increase for lots of reasons. I think that if we were to increase property taxes, they're highly visible. They are regressive. Frankly, almost all of our revenue options are regressive. The poor will pay more. Now, we still are lower than normal when it comes to utility taxes on some of those fronts. And that's how we earmarked money for our pensions 4 years ago, is we increased those about a half a percent. And so we earmarked that money for pensions. So I don't agree that the property taxes are inevitable, or increases are inevitable. Now, we might have something like, I believe the figure was $19 a year to put in an aquatic center on the west side.
$19,000?
No, $19 per household.
Okay.
And so if we're talking about a comparatively small amount of money that is earmarked for a special project that is really critical for a region of our city that has not had a lot of investment, public or private, I think that might be something. But I think our macro level city finances, yeah, I don't know that we need to go down the path of property.
But you still have to find
tax.
Another couple million next year. You dealt with $3 million this year in structural problems, another couple million next year.
That's right.
And hopefully it'll reduce to $1 million in the year following if past year's forecasts are correct. So another couple million, what are you going to do?
Well, okay, good question. But some of it depends on where it is and where those things are coming from. We also have retired debt that is about to end. We've got bonds that are about to be paid off, and now we will probably issue bonds for capital projects. We have been neglecting our capital improvement projects for quite a long time. And so that's something that we're going to be dealing with this summer. But that doesn't necessarily have to mean that it's a property tax increase, or at least a property tax increase that's not extremely small and very, very tightly targeted. I think that there are other options. One, for example, would be a gas tax of 4 cents. The thing about a gas tax for 4 cents is
that didn't gain a lot of favor under
it didn't
council,
gain a lot of favor
discussions
but
this year.
That didn't get a lot of favor. We'll see what happens. A lot of that is absorbed by the marketplace. The other thing is 30 cents on the dollar of that is paid by people who do not live in Bloomington but drive on our roads. So if we are able to divert some money because of, let's say, a 4 cent increase in a gas tax, that is less visible, that's less regressive, I would favor that type of approach.
You met with State Farm Insurance yesterday. Sure. They said they're going to sell the building. How does that shape city efforts to find a good use for that from a private entity or a public-private partnership?
Well, I think that we had a very productive meeting. I think that was one that we're going to continue to work with State Farm as we move forward to find the highest and best use for that that facility. And the likelihood that we will find that State Farm will find a single entity that's willing to buy it with a single purpose is probably not terribly high, but it could be that a developer buys it and then says, hey, you get to have from the ninth floor all the way up, you get the seventh and eighth floor, and you get the sixth through the second floor, and then somebody else gets the first floor. So it is very likely that it will need to be a multi-use facility moving forward, mm-hmm. and we're very happy to work with State Farm on that, and we certainly solidified those contacts last night.
Alderman Karen Schmidt said during an interview Monday on Sound Ideas, she cannot support the third draft of a welcoming city ordinance proposal because it limits legitimate police communication with federal authorities too much. What are the prospects now? And what?
Well, I don't know
count?
What she's talking about in terms of a third draft. We had a draft back in early January that was developed by our city staff pursuant to
the current draft then.
Yes.
The current draft.
And that particular draft was approved by the not only our attorneys, but also by the police chief.
This is another proposal from the coalition that
goes
further than
the
state law.
I understand.
So that's the one she can't support.
If that's the one that she can't support, that still doesn't mean that we can't come up with some sort of compromise language.
She also says that she's been asking to have a good, robust community conversation about all the things that work and the things that we need to do better, and she views that wider community conversation as a prerequisite to consideration of any ordinance. So that would slow roll the ordinance even more than the 16 months it's already been going. What does that say about your respective views about the role of alderman and mayor?
Well, I think that there's definitely a culture on the Bloomington City Council generally of being process-focused. Mayors have to be results-focused. I'm concerned about results and making things happen, and that is a constant tension between council members and mayors in most cities. But some of it, especially if they're elected from wards.
If she's a swing vote, mm-hmm. potentially,
correct.
And if she's unwilling to go forward without this broader conversation, how do you address that concern of hers?
Well, I think we could say, what do you mean by a broader conversation, and how long does that take, and when do we go to what point, and what is the point of the broader conversation? What are we going to find out from that broader conversation that we do not know now?
Mayor Terry Renner, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks, Charlie.
The mayor of the city of Bloomington, I'm Charlie Schlenker.
And I'm Mike McCurdy. The mayors of Bloomington and Normal join us most Tuesdays following Monday evening council meetings. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from the Illinois Prairie Community Foundation, a grant-making organization committed to helping you meet your philanthropic goals through donor-advised funds, endowments, scholarships, and more. More information at ilprairiecf.org. This is 89.1 GLT and wglt.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Kansas City is poised to become the smartest of smart cities in the next 5 years, according to the city employee leading that effort. Bob Bennett is the chief innovation officer for Kansas City, Missouri. Under his direction, Kansas City, Missouri has a suite of initiatives, including deep data analysis, public Wi-Fi, digital kiosks, and smart street lighting. Bennett addresses the annual McLean County Regional Planning Commission's Community Information Forum tomorrow. There are a number of ways to define smart city. Bennett has his definition for Kansas City.
For us in Kansas City, we define smart as a city which uses technological tools, be they sensors or be they analytical platforms, to do those things which cities have historically done more efficiently, better, or with a greater impact on our citizens. And that ranges from everything from maintaining our streets, maintaining our water systems, to focusing our police assets.
You've said it's not about gadgets, it's about data. What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that people problems are the things that cities have had to work toward solving for generations. We will always provide a safe place for people to do business. We will always provide a safe place for people to live. In America today, we anticipate that when you walk into any hotel room, you're going to have electricity and you're going to have flush toilets and water that you can drink from the tap without having to sterilize it by boiling or applying iodine or other solutions. In a similar way, we are now moving toward a point where all of these systems are going to be improved with technology. And so that's kind of the route that we are taking. And it's the same spectrum of things that we need to focus on. In some cases, we can use data to understand how a road is behaving, and that's going to change the way we do street maintenance, allowing us to predict potholes. And instead of waiting for your car to break, we're actually going out and doing maintenance. In some cases, we are out measuring the flow of water in our storm sewers and wastewater sewers and diverting that liquid underground so I don't have to build a new pumping plant, saving our city $980 million. And in other cases, it's just knowing where crimes are likely to occur and changing the behavior of your community to meet that need.
Let's just start with the last one. How can you predict where crime may happen?
It's actually a multivariable calculation when you look at crime. It is no longer just the policeman's problem to look at crime. In any community which drags their police chief before the city council to get yelled at when crime increases, isn't looking at the totality of causes that we could otherwise influence to prevent crime. Most crimes occur in the summertime on the hottest days. If we're able to build a park with a pool and open that pool earlier because of where the temperatures are, that may allow us to divert someone who would otherwise be bored to that pool instead of committing a crime. If we look at some of the jobs programs we have and where we recruit kids from during the summertime, we can understand where kids get arrested from and instead put a jobs program there, taking those kids off the streets and giving them something different to do. If we look at some of the other causes of crime, we can change city policy or change city activities to mitigate that cause before the crime occurs.
So in some respects, it sounds like a smart city is simply using the data to be ultra responsive.
Or even proactive. And that's where I really want to be, is instead of responding faster, which is I think what cool cities do, a smart city anticipates the problem before it occurs and fixes it when it's a maintenance issue and not a crisis response.
So how and why did Kansas City embark on this path?
The how was a matter somewhat of convenience. We were very fortunate in the year 2013 to start construction on a $100 million streetcar project, which was an amazing opportunity for our city, but it was also an amazing headache for our residents and our store owners down on Main Street when we tore up a main thoroughfare and kept it torn up for the better part of 18 months. And so what we did was we partnered with Cisco and with Sprint, gave them the opportunity to take advantage of that big hole in the ground and to put in additional fiber, to put in additional conduit, and to upgrade all of our streetlights with LED streetlights and sensors, and to actually build out this network so that we did it right in a 21st century manner the first time. And that way, when the streetcar was completed in May of 2016, we also had a full smart city apparatus that from a city perspective only cost us about $3.4 million out of a $20 million project.
So is becoming a public, is becoming a smart city, is that a public service, or is it about being competitive with other cities, or is that even a meaningful distinction anymore?
I think it is a public service in that 21st century citizens expect 21st century connectivity. Anybody that you see right now who is under the age of 25 has a cell phone and expects that that cell phone will connect them to transportation options, connect them to jobs, connect them to shopping, connect them to their friends, connect them to their family. We expect that those same citizens, as they take an increasing role in governing our communities, are going to want to be able to pay their water bill on that same platform, are going to want to be able to provide a 311 comment to our city on that same platform. They're going to want to be able to have that same interaction with that same platform. And so we're going to have to evolve with it.
So what kind of budget are we talking about? What percentage of KCMO's overall budget goes to this kind of innovation and smart city projects?
Right now, our phase one project cost about $23 million of that. The city put forth $3 million. Mm-hmm. Almost half of that was in kind. The other half was obligated funds. So the rest of the funding came from private sector partners, and it became a public-private partnership, wherein Sprint and Cisco were able to build a business case from which they're able to generate profit. And we as a city we're able to build out a system which allows us to provide this public service.
This is Sound Ideas. Bob Bennett is the Chief Innovation Officer for Kansas City, Missouri, and he's addressing the McLean County Regional Planning Commission's annual Community Information Forum. What's the return on investment, and what sort of metrics are you monitoring to see if Kansas City's investment is paying off?
On the dollar side ROI, the city has generated about $140,000 worth of profit from the advertising that airs on our kiosks. Hmm. About 50% of that content is advertising. And so we're able to use that to fund all of our smart city maintenance. So all of the sensors and network maintenance, network upgrades, those things the city has to do that are not part of the warrantied bits and pieces. In terms of other metrics that we use, over 8 million people have engaged with our public Wi-Fi, which spans 54 blocks. And we only have 482,000 Kansas Cityans. So essentially, we've had, 16x usage of that Wi-Fi network from either multiple use of about 2.9 million individual users or the use by visitors when they come in for different conventions and other activities and take advantage of that free Wi-Fi service. In terms of how many people have used our kiosks, that number right now is about 700,000. Individual usages, we think about 280,000 individual users. In terms of the amount of data and the amount of times that our data have been accessed on our open portal, that number is running at about 1.4 million.
Is millennial population growth something you're looking at, either retaining that demographic in Kansas City or attracting younger people to live in Kansas City, live and work, call Kansas City home?
I wouldn't say millennial as a specific focus. I'll tell you that our population in our downtown has grown fivefold since the year 2000. Certainly millennials make up a large percentage of that, but baby boomers are also returning to downtown after raising their kids, launching them, and then either coming into quasi-retirement or retirement years. Closer to a downtown, which has an art scene and a streetcar and really cool restaurants and places to recreate and take advantage of what a community has to offer.
So you've talked about this Wi-Fi system that you've put into downtown. What about addressing the digital divide or providing access to high-speed internet to everyone, regardless of income or where they live? Is that something Kansas City is trying to address?
Absolutely. We are currently looking at expanding our smart city footprint from the smartest 54 blocks in America right along the heart of Main Street to the remainder of the city. And the first section of the city where we are expanding these same capabilities in terms of Wi-Fi and sensors and a focused analysis are east of Troost Avenue, which is the proverbial tracks here in Kansas City. Right now, we are working with Sprint and their 1 million program to put Wi-Fi repeaters in multiple locations throughout the eastern one-third of our city. We are incredibly fortunate as a community to have partnerships with Google Fiber, with AT&T, with Spectrum, and with other fiber providers, to the point that our metro area has about 5.5 million strand miles of fiber, and 97% of our residents have a cable with fiber access available to them, either in their housing area or at the driveway of their home.
That's Bob Bennett. He's the Chief Information Officer for Kansas City, Missouri, and he's the speaker at the McLean County Regional Planning Commission's annual Community Information Forum. Bob, we talked about data and the data that drives gadgets, sensors, equipment. Let's talk about smart streetlights. You talked about those a moment ago. What is a smart streetlight?
So in Kansas City today, we have 178 smart streetlights. These lights have in their core of the streetlight pole itself a small processor. It is essentially a computer that is as powerful as your cell phone computer. Located in the top of the light itself is a sensor, which counts the number of people underneath it. Essentially, it is like a small person up there with a chalkboard just doing tick marks to count the number of folks underneath it. When that number is between 0 and 4 people, and it is during hours of darkness, the light is illuminated at about 65% of the wattage that is available to the pole. Since it's an LED light, the actual lumens available underneath it are about equal to what you have in a normal 4-sodium light. But certainly, being both an LED light and working at 65% efficacy, the drag on the electricity grid is much smaller for that individual light. When the light perceives that there are more than 5 people under it, it increases the wattage up to about 85% or 90%. And it's not unless the police need to really see at the same quality as daylight that they manually increase the wattage to 100%. So we're able to save energy with that smart street light. We're able to meet the needs of a changing population underneath it by virtue of it counting it itself. The other thing that that small computer inside the light pole does is it counts the traffic that drives by, both that which goes straight through the intersection and that which makes a left turn, which allows us to better manage the timing of our streetlights and decrease the congestion in the heart of Main Street. We've gotten to the point now where traffic through that 2.2 miles of Kansas City has decreased in average time by 36 seconds. Which is probably not significant for my daughter, who's generally 5 to 8 minutes late when she's going to youth group on a Wednesday. But from a greenhouse gas emissions perspective, sure. When you talk about 15,000 cars that drive through there every day, that is a lot less car emissions that are polluting my airspace.
But the light, the street light never completely goes out. It's always providing some light at night.
That's correct. Yeah. And in fact, the light that it's providing is a greater intensity than what we had less than a year and a half ago or 2 years ago when we started the Smart City project.
The one thing we haven't talked about yet, and we've talked about them here a little bit, is Kansas City's kiosks. What do they do? How did you determine where they would be located?
So the kiosk program actually came out of New York City. The two guys who invented it actually did it as a result of 9/11 and trying to find a way to tell people where to seek shelter and when and why. Because at the time, the sort of first wave of the ubiquitous cell phone to the point of people blowing it off while it's ringing in their pocket was occurring. So the idea was to put up a 7-foot-tall iPhone in the middle of the public right-of-way that, in our case, if a tornado or severe weather comes, I can direct people off of the streets and into a building for shelter at a hyper-local level. Given the fact that we're a 317-square-mile city, I may have a tornadic activity in the Northland, but not south of the river. And I could obviously just focus those efforts appropriately. We brought Smart City Media on board. They were from the city of New York. What they determined was that we could, by the city owning those devices, use half of the time that that screen was active with city information, things like get out the vote campaigns, where to go to register your pets, where to go to lodge a city 311 complaint, performance data with different city departments, art festival information, other things that citizens need to know as a public information channel. And then we use the other 50% of the time available on that screen for advertising. And what we've just done is added beacons to the inside of those kiosks. So the advertising that will pop up on that screen when you walk by it will be advertising that appeals to you. Again, you've got your Wings application on your telephone. It will tell you the top 10 places for Wings in Kansas City. And if you push the screen at that point, because it's an interactive experience, it can give you an opportunity to maybe get a deal at one of them. Get a free iced tea with your order of Wings today. Give us your phone number. We'll send you a text message. And then we'll put on your phone wayfinding to get you to that location. So these are the types of things the kiosks do for us. Today, there are 28 of them in the city. We are currently installing several more at our airport along a bus rapid transit line and on the campus of the University of Missouri, Kansas City, which here within 18 months will get us to 108 machines. And to this point, we've generated $140,000 or so worth of profit for the city that allows us to continue its expansion.
So what is some low-hanging fruit that any city the size of Bloomington Normal, perhaps, could or should reach for to move toward being a smarter city?
I think the first thing you can do is you can be a better business partner, either for inbound businesses from an economic development perspective or with your existing businesses to help them figure out where the best location is for a new coffee shop. You can do that by doing a quality assessment of your permitting data, understanding where people are putting in homes or where people are improving their homes tells you at the nearest commercially zoned area where there's an opportunity to put in a successful coffee shop or a restaurant or that sort of thing. I think when you look at the education data and you see where children are doing well and you see where children are doing less well, that may be a signal to you to put in some of your digital equity strategic plan elements. If that's computer training, if that's collaborating with a local fiber provider to give physical access to the internet, or if there's just an opportunity there based on which scores are not doing so well to put in extra tutors or to find public-private partnership programs where companies who need people with a specific skill can train up a population that's eager and ready to embrace that new idea. And oh, by the way, huge opportunity base right in this neighborhood. And that's just two real quick examples.
And where is Kansas City headed?
Kansas City is going to be the smartest city on planet Earth within 5 years. And I think that that's going to happen as a result, number one, of the work that we've done for our first phase. Number two, the fact that we do have a data-centric culture inside City Hall, and there is a willingness of our city government to embrace not only our own data sets, there's about 4,200 of those, but also censored data and algorithms, which get us to the predictivity point. And the third thing is we're willing to embrace private sector data as well. When you look at some of the credit card companies, there is publicly available data, and it's anonymized at about the zip code level, which tells you how much is billed to a certain zip code and where that money is actually spent in terms of the zip codes where it is spent. You can actually track the flow of your economy using that information. And by combining all three of those together, you truly get to a point of smartification. And that's where we're heading.
Okay, Bob, thanks for your time on Sound Ideas. We appreciate it.
Hey, I look forward to seeing you guys here at breakfast on the 11th. This is going to be a lot of fun.
Bob Bennett became the chief innovation officer for the city of Kansas City, Missouri in January of 2016 after a 25-year career in the U.S. Army. And he joined us during Sound Ideas via the internet. He's the keynote speaker at the McLean County Regional Planning Commission's Community Information Forum tomorrow morning. Bennett says he's hearing from citizens that they want as many city services digitized as possible. He also says Kansas City has a robust privacy policy to encourage online use of all of Kansas City's technological services. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
So
Support for GLT comes from the BCPA, presenting award-winning actor Frank Ferrante in his acclaimed portrayal of comedian Groucho Marx, Saturday, April 14th. It's an evening of hilarity and audience participation as Ferrante ad-libs throughout in grand Groucho style. Comedy for all ages. Tickets at artsblooming.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A painter and his muse find love at a roller disco. Yep, that's the plot to an infamous film flop from the 80s that has found new life as campy musical theater. Laura Kennedy has more.
Illinois Wesleyan University Theater is turning McPherson Theater into a roller disco for the musical Xanadu. Directed by Gene Kerr and assisted directed by Carson Gray, the show opens tonight. And like a number of popular Broadway shows right now, the musical is based on a movie. You might remember it. The original film came out in 1980 and starred Olivia Newton-John and Gene Kelly. And in spite of the talented cast, plus music from ELO's Jeff Lynne, the film didn't exactly do boffo box office. In fact, director Gene Kerr says it was an epic bomb. But Xanadu didn't slink away quietly.
It later, however, received a cult following, and that cult following just adored Xanadu, the film, much in the same way that people adore Rocky Horror Picture Show.
You mean it's so bad it's good?
It's
kind of a
so
thing.
Bad it's good. And so a group of energetic artists in New York decided to piece together a schlocky musical, and it is. It was a schlocky film. It's a schlocky musical. And they pieced it together, and even in the script, it says, you know, in the 80s, the arts are just devoid of anything value. They'll just take some terrible film and put together some terrible pop tunes, and they'll string it together and call it a musical.
So it's very self-aware.
It's very self-aware. And that's the fun. That's the fun of it.
So we're having fun. This is not a serious redo of Xanadu. It's tongue-in-cheek and having fun all the way. Carson, tell me about the music. I remember the music from the film. I like the music from the film. Jeff Lynne from ELO did the music. Is a lot of the music still intact for the Broadway production?
Yeah, I would say a majority of it is. And they obviously threw in a couple more songs just to throw, because it's a, I would call it a spoof of the movie.
Yeah.
Is that a pretty
it's
fair?
It's a send-up.
Yeah.
So there's fresh material. If you've seen the film, you haven't seen the play.
That is correct.
Right.
The people who've written about Xanadu, this musical is much better than the film. It's still a spoof.
Let's talk about some of the songs that actually made it from the film to the play. I remember one that I really liked, which was I'm Alive. Did that actually make it in?
Absolutely. That's the opening number, actually.
So we have Olivia Newton-John, of course, a wonderful Australian artist, and she plays a muse who inspires this painter. Tell me about your lead who's playing this muse. The name is...
Kara Ryan.
Kara Ryan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is she going with a full-on Aussie accent? Are we
she
keeping that?
She sure is. Kara is a wonderful music theater major. She's a junior. Mm-hmm. And she is our Kira. She is sweetness and light, and she's giving, and that is Kara Ryan, the actress, and that is Kira, our muse. She is going full on Aussie, but Aussie only happens in the world of humans, all right? So when the muses talk amongst themselves, they talk with a very British RP dialect. Think Shakespeare on steroids.
Yeah. Why did you guys want to be involved in this, Carson?
Being in my sophomore year as a music theater major also, I figured it'd be a really good opportunity to really get behind the scenes and figure out how the creative process starts and really start to... I never disrespected the process in the first place by any means, but I just gained a much more valued respect, if that makes sense, in terms of how many people are involved, what it takes to really bring out the creative process, and just how fun it can be when it all comes together well and it's just a fun camaraderie.
Let me toot to Carson's horn a little bit for him. He's taken on the role of an assistant director, but he's also taken on the role of dramaturg for us. He's done a lot of research and done some posting. We have a closed Facebook group for the cast, and a lot of information has been going up there that Carson has generated to help them understand what muses are, what the original Broadway cast was like, what's important, that there really is a Xanadu, there is in China.
Mm-hmm. And Xanadu to Kubla Khan, a stately pleasure dome.
That's yes. right. Oh, yes, I'm impressed. Exactly. Well done. Yes.
There you go.
Thank you, Mr. Coleridge. Do you really need to be familiar with the film to enjoy this musical?
No.
Mm-mm. I would say no.
No. I think being familiar with the film deepens your joy in the musical because you understand the parody and the send-up of mm-hmm. it all.
Well, of course, there was a lot of roller skating in the film. Does that translate to the play? And how do you manage actors on roller skates?
Well, thank you for bringing that up. When people think of Xanadu, they do think there's a lot of roller skating, right? And that's not exactly true. Kira, our muse, she is on skates for 80% of the show.
Whoa.
But she's the only one. The rest of the cast gets on skates only at the end. Now, there's a moment when Sonny, our male lead, finds himself on skates because it's his dream to open a roller disco. So he does demonstrate that he knows his way around some skates. But yeah, the big moment of the cast being in the roller disco is when it's actually realized and Xanadu the roller disco opens and they all skate around. So what did we do? We partnered with the local skating roller rink here in town, Skate in Place. And Tim and Diane are the owners there, and they have been wonderful for us. We took the cast starting late January, mm-hmm. At least once a week, to the roller rink, and they mentored our entire cast to help them feel comfortable on skates. Some of our cast have been on skates. Almost all of those who had been on skates were inline skates, not quad skates.
Yeah.
So that was a bit of a transition. And I would say Tim and his family have just embraced us, and we could not be more grateful to what they've done for us.
You have to believe we are magic. Nothing can stand in our way. To believe we are magic. Don't let your aim ever stray. And if all your hopes survive, destiny will arrive. I'll bring all your dreams alive for you.
So what does Xanadu teach us about creativity and muses?
I think it is about creativity, but I think there's a deeper meaning here. And what we have here is the humans in this story have lost their way. They don't know who they are anymore. So when I look at Xanadu and I want to know why, what's the message, what do I want to say with it, it's know who you are, follow your dream, and everything will work out okay, and you'll get Xanadu.
To me, Xanadu means a state of divine pleasure, a state of finally accepting the joys of life and where you're at, and not taking anything for granted.
That's director Gene Kerr and assistant director Carson Gray. Xanadu runs through Sunday at McPherson Theater on the IWU campus in Bloomington. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Director Gene Kerr says there's opportunities for the performers to interact with the audience during Xanadu, and as you might have hoped, glow sticks are involved. It's sound ideas and music from Xanadu.
Everybody's got the world. Everybody's got the world.
from Xanadu on stage at IWU's McPherson Theater through Sunday. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find the Sound Ideas interviews and stories you heard today, with help from Ryan Denham, Laura Kennedy, and News Director Charlie Schlinker. Also, thanks to Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner for his time today. Find the full show podcast at WGLT.org or Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet your comments or retweet GLT's tweets. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. I'm at Mike McCurdy. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.